welcome to the Business Standard Morning Show. My name is Ishan Gera, and here are the stories for the day. India Inc.'s yearly outlook is the most cautious in a decade. That is the finding of PwC's annual Global CEO survey. It comes at a time when India is being seen as a bright spot in the global economy that is beset with recession fears. So what are the domestic and global factors driving India Inc.'s outlook? Bhaskar Kumar answers.
Advisory firm PwC released the annual Global CEO survey at the ongoing World Economic Forum in Davos on Monday. The survey suggested that while Indian CEOs were a tad bit optimistic about the country's growth in the face of global headwinds, their global peers were not that positive. Nearly 6 out of 10 corporate heads in India were optimistic about the country's growth prospects in 2023, the survey said. But at the same time, the report also said that the responses by Indian CEOs marked a dramatic shift from the mood in 2021, when 99% had said that the country's economic growth would improve over the next 12 months. The firm said that it was the most cautious outlook in over a decade. About 41% of Indian CEOs believe that their organizations will not be economically viable in 10 years if they continue on their current course. Climate change has also gained prominence as a cause of concern over the next 5 years, with 31% of Indian CEOs saying that their companies will be highly exposed to it. The survey found that compared to Indian CEOs, only 37% of Asia-Pacific CEOs and 29% of global CEOs expected economic growth to improve in their countries or regions over the next 12 months. The survey was conducted in the last quarter of 2022. About 4,400 CEOs from over 100 countries, including 68 from India, participated in it. A mix of both positive and negative domestic and global factors may be driving the cautious sentiment among India Inc.'s leaders. First, there is a broad consensus that North America and Europe will see a recession this year. The PwC survey also showed that 78% of CEOs in India and 73% of global CEOs believe that global economic growth would decline over the next 12 months. According to PwC, this is the most pessimistic that the CEOs have been in over 12 years. Recession fears in developed economies have led to a slowdown in external demand, which is already affecting India's outbound shipments. The country's merchandise exports contracted over 12% year-on-year in December to about $34.5 billion. Additionally, China's opening up may help the global economy, but its economy slowed sharply in the fourth quarter, dragging down 2022 growth to one of its worst in nearly half a century. There is also uncertainty around how Beijing will deal with the growing number of COVID-19 infections. Back home in India, inflation had remained above the central bank's upper tolerance band for most of 2022, but there has been respite on that front. In December, CPI-based inflation eased marginally to 5.7%, staying within the Reserve Bank of India's tolerance range of 2-6%. In November, CPI was at an 11-month low of 5.88%. But RBI Governor Shaktikanta Das has also repeatedly emphasized the importance of bringing down elevated core inflation. There are also apprehensions that the rising prices of non-perishable items may not allow food inflation to cool soon. Overall, India Inc. may be worried that the pandemic-induced pent-up demand that propped up consumption in 2022 despite inflation may not continue in 2023. The first advance estimates of GDP for FY23 have shown that consumption is expected to show a strong recovery as the economy bounces back from 2 years of the COVID pandemic. In nominal terms, private final consumption expenditure, which is a proxy for household consumption, is expected to rise to 164 trillion rupees in FY23, up from 140.9 trillion in FY22 and 120.3 trillion in FY21. However, analysts have said that the current consumption demand is highly skewed in favor of goods and services consumed by households falling in the upper income bracket. Thus, they have warned that a broad-based consumption recovery is still some distance away. Economists have also warned that most of the improvement in private final consumption expenditure came due to pent-up demand in the first half of the year, and that a slowdown was being seen in the second half. They added that this slowdown would continue in FY24, even though India would avoid a recession. Ultimately, this could be the factor behind India Inc. leaders adopting a cautious outlook.
They know that consumption, which accounts for 60% of aggregate demand, which is GDP, has only barely crossed the 1920 level. In per capita terms, it would have just barely crossed it. And please remember, when we say per capita, that's the national average. And we know perfectly well that the distribution of income and hence consumption has been worsening, because unemployment has been at a historic high in the recent past.
Internationally, the world is now going through a very turbulent phase. The world markets are fragmenting, protectionism is on the rise, investment climate is worsening. The Ukraine-Russia conflict has also worsened the same situation. And then the Chinese economy now being hit with the COVID, etc., means that the demand is lower. So all these uncertainties on the global stage is the cause for that caution, which I think is quite well understood. On the domestic front, the caution is exercised because rural consumption doesn't seem to have strengthened as much as it could have.
In the lead up to the budget, top industry bodies have called for rationalizing personal tax rates in a bid to increase broad-based consumption. Apart from that, what more can be done to improve India Inc.'s outlook?
Well, the first and most important thing that it could and should do is to cut the indirect taxes on petrol, diesel and gas, because that is an input into so many commodities which has been driving inflation. Joblessness is so high that even low rates of inflation are impacting the vast majority of the population. The second thing that I'm expecting the government to do in the budget is to, like last year, provide for state-level capital expenditure. The reason why they should provide it to state governments is because the nature of their capex, of their infrastructure in this expenditure, is such that it generates more jobs because it's less capital intensive.
Well, within the budget, what the government could do is to try and allocate a larger sums for agriculture investment, and also encourage banks to lend, increase their priority sector lending to the small and medium enterprises, to the agricultural sector and to the exporting sector, so that the demand there goes up. The second part would be, of course, that the government can continue with its pro-capital expenditure policy.
The government has been pushing up public investment to crowd in private investment, but not with much success. While enabling factors like capacity utilization and bank and corporate balance sheets have improved, job creation may prove to be the missing ingredient that could improve India Inc.'s growth outlook and lead to an investment revival.
Indian economy, meanwhile, is still resilient. Fast adoption of digital payments is one of the reasons. And UPI has the main role to play in mainstreaming the digital payments. The NPCI is now extending the UPI service to NRIs in 10 countries who can use their international numbers to send money back home. So how will it change the life of NRIs? And how will it impact existing remittance-focused players? Our report by Tushar Verma answers all these questions. We'll be right back.
The Unified Payments Interface, or UPI, is now all set to make the lives of NRIs a bit easier. Indians living in 10 countries will soon be able to use their international numbers to send money back home, instantly and without paying any extra charge. Most of the remittance that India receives is from these 10 countries. According to the World Bank, India received about $90 billion in remittances in 2021. NRIs with non-resident external account or NRE account and non-resident ordinary account or NRO account will be able to transfer money instantly 24/7 through UPI. A NRE account is an account opened in India by a NRI to deposit their foreign earnings. While on the other hand, a NRO account is one which is also used by a NRI but to deposit income earned in India like rent and dividend. So will this move disrupt the remittance market?
So, you know, I think it has the potential to actually completely revolutionize cross-border payments, just like UPI completely transformed domestic digital payments. I think the one big USP of UPI is it focuses on customer convenience, easy interface and usability, and low costs, and it's available 24/7. These are not features that are available for the existing remittance and cross-border schemes that are available today.
The most well-known ways to transfer money are wire transfers, through money transfers companies like Western Union, and through online platforms like PayPal, Payoneer, etc. Wire transfer takes about 48 hours. Others too are not instant and take time. Adoption of UPI is expected to disrupt this market. With an easy and instant mode of payment, it is expected that people will shift to UPI from traditional wire transfer and using services of money transfer companies. Since its inception, the UPI-based transactions have increased considerably. In the second quarter of FY23, UPI accounted for 49% of all transactions by volume and 67% in value in P2P transactions. While on the other hand, transactions using debit and credit cards were at 8% in volume and 14% in value. So, will the adoption of UPI impact the businesses of existing players in the remittance market?
To begin with, there will be not much of a, you know, impact. I mean, there will be different spaces. People who are more tech savvy, they will have UPI till they get onboarded. So initially, they will kind of coexist. But over time, I do not see any competition to UPI as a payment service. Eventually, because the technology is not the same, the experience is not the same, and that infrastructure can never provide that same experience, I see over time UPI just taking over completely. Competing businesses that are there, if they feel that strain that, okay, UPI is taking a large market share, they will be forced to either innovate and figure out some better way of, you know, because at cost, I'm not sure how they will be able to compete.
With NPCI planning to extend UPI services to NRIs, the players in the market have already started to innovate. Zaire, a Dubai-based fintech startup, has reportedly acquired Rive, a Bangalore-based startup that provides credit card holders the facility of scan and pay. With this acquisition, Zaire will be able to easily integrate UPI into its system. So will the adoption of UPI lead to UPI-focused innovations, mergers and acquisitions?
So mergers and acquisitions will maybe come a little later, but the beauty of this is that I am quite excited to see how this pans out is that all UPI itself in India, the local infrastructure, they've already come out with UPI 2.0, auto pay. You know, there are the product is not stopping even in India. Now, this same technology can very directly be applicable. Those innovations are now going to happen at a larger scale. I mean, the innovations are going to be the same. The impact of that innovation is going to be not just limited to India.
One thing is certain. With increased usage of UPI, the remittance process will become much easier. Furthermore, like in India, people may start using UPI for small expenses abroad. But will this easier process lead to an increased remittance?
I mean, to be honest, I see a very marginal increase because people who wanted to send money, they will still send money. Like when I was a student and I had to receive money, I had to receive money. But I see a lot more smaller ticket transactions. You know, people earlier in the day, people will have to plan in advance. That will come down. I see much smaller ticket sizes that the number of transactions will increase. But I think remittances will take its natural progression.
The adoption of UPI by NRIs may prove to be a game changer for the remittance market. The existing players in the market, particularly banks and money transfer companies, will have to innovate to adapt to the increased usage of UPI. However, even though the process of remittance will become easier, it may not necessarily correspond to an increase in remittance.
Meanwhile, as the cold wave took North India into its grip, the demand for power crossed 200 gigawatt last week. This was close to peak demand of 216 gigawatt recorded in summer months last year. After power stocks delivered up to three-digit returns in calendar year 2022, analysts forecast a robust year ahead for the sector. Lavisha Dharat brings you a detailed report.
After witnessing a flat growth in October 2022 due to heavy rains, power generation in the country rebounded to double digits in November-December 2022, leading to 8% year-on-year growth in Q3 FY23, while the generation from thermal units rose 7.3% year-on-year during the quarter, renewable energy generation jumped 25%. Going ahead, CRISIL Market Intelligence and Analytics pegs power demand growth in the range of 6-7% year-on-year in Q4 FY23. This, it said, would be on the back of the intense cold wave and a pickup in economic activity. The softening prices of coal in international markets, coupled with favorable government policies, are expected to bode well for power stocks.
If you look at the data in the past 3 months, the demand for power in October actually dropped by 2.9%. However, November and December saw strong double-digit growth. This was on back of significant recovery that we saw in the industrial and commercial segment. Now, with Indian manufacturing PMI remaining strong, we expect this buoyancy in power demand to continue, at least in near term. Over medium term, we expect the growth in power to be in mid to high single digits, given the favorable government policies like Power for All and even improving financials of state DISCOMs. On the company's front, the regulated companies should benefit in near term from improving load factors, and over longer term, growth will be led by increasing capacities. Interestingly, while power demand has been strong, the volumes on power exchanges have been sluggish. The international coal prices have cooled off from their peak in September, and we expect the domestic coal prices to follow through. So with lower spot prices, we expect the power volumes on exchanges to bounce back.
Analysts believe that the rebound in power demand is positive for Tata Power, CESE, and Indian Energy Exchange.
India's power demand grew strongly in the month of November and December, post a muted demand in the month of October due to extended monsoons. Overall, the power consumption in the country grew by almost 8.5% on a YoY basis in Q3 FY23. Higher power demand bodes well for companies like Tata Power, CESE, and also for IEX, which sells the power through exchanges. Having said that, a large part of the power company's earnings is regulated. They earn a regulated return on equity on their equity capital. Thus, the increase in the power demand is adjusted for the tariffs. Having said that, the strong commercialization plan by NTPC and Tata Power's focus to transform its towards the renewable energy will drive growth for both these companies. We prefer NTPC, Tata Power and Power Grid in the power sector.
On the bourses, meanwhile, shares of Adani Power, CG Power, NHPC and NTPC have surged up to 61% so far in FY23. In comparison, the S&P BSE Power Index has climbed around 12%, while the S&P BSE Sensex Index has rallied about 3% during the same period. Today, global cues, earnings season, foreign flows and crude oil prices will dictate market sentiments.
After the markets, let us shift our focus to the global supply chain, which saw big disruption during the pandemic. India too was hit, but the government is working to stave off any such future crisis. The work on the country's first mega container transshipment port, which is coming up at Galathea Bay in Great Nicobar Island, is expected to begin soon. Expression of interest is likely to be floated in the few days from now. Once operational, this terminal will host large international container ships. In our decoded segment, we tell what is a transshipment port and also explain why this new terminal is crucial for India.
Thank you.
While announcing the country's first mega container transshipment port at Galathea Bay, Prime Minister Narendra Modi had in 2020 said that India was looking to establish itself as an important player in the global supply and value chain. And for that, strengthening the network of waterways and ports was crucial. Now, about 2 years later, the Kolkata port has said that expression of interest for the port at Galathea Bay in Great Nicobar Island at Andaman and Nicobar Islands is expected to be floated by the end of January. Transshipment is the act of offloading cargo containers from a large ship and putting it on a smaller ship, which then carries the shipment to the final destination. Small ports don't have the infrastructure to accommodate large international containers. These small ports, or the ports away from the major cargo ship routes, rely on transshipment ports to collect or deliver the containers in relatively smaller ships. So transshipment hubs are the intermediate ports where the goods are taken to before delivering that to the final destinations. Transshipment ports have greater facilities to manage the huge amount of ship and container traffic. Port of Colombo in Sri Lanka and Singapore Port are examples of transshipment ports. According to reports, over 75% of India's transshipment cargo is still being handled at international ports. Colombo, Singapore and Klang in Malaysia handle more than 75% of India's transshipment cargo. Colombo alone handles over 40% of cargo meant for India. Even about 70% of the cargo from Bangladesh and Myanmar is diverted to Singapore, from where it is brought here in smaller ships. But why? Because India does not have a large deep port where huge foreign liners can dock. Most big container ships, which are as large as a 10-story building or more and carry about 20,000 to 25,000 containers, need about 20-meter or even more depth to dock. Although Indian ports are handling some traffic, the country clearly needs a huge transshipment port. India is now going to build a large transshipment port close to the southernmost tip of the country at Galathea Bay in Nicobar Island. Two of the most important qualifying factors for a transshipment port are its location and its depth. Big ships in the major routes demand more depth, which is referred to as draft in shipping. Draft is the height from the underwater base of the ship to the water surface. The big cargo ships that run in the busiest international route need a minimum depth of 19 meters to sail through a port. Also, a transshipment port will have several feeder ports to deliver the container that arrived to the cargo ship. From a mainline service. It is crucial for India to increase the port capacity through developing transshipment ports. According to reports, due to lack of sufficient draft and good container management systems, several international shipping companies were skipping Indian ports. Having a large transshipment port will save India more money in foreign exchange and will boost the development of other ports in the country. The crucial geographical location and 20 meters of natural depth at Galathea Bay makes it a good choice for a container terminal. The two major international ship routes, one through Strait of Hormuz and other through Suez Canal, enters the Indian Ocean from the west and passes near to the Bay of Galathea before going to the busiest ship route in the world, to Malacca Strait. The Galathea Bay is closer to Malacca Strait, where 40% of the world trade passes through.
The nation's trusted bank, SBI, the banker to every Indian.
Galathea Bay is also the home to leatherbacks, the world's largest sea turtles, which nest on the Silver Island. It also has a wildlife sanctuary. About 80% of the island is marked as a forest reserve. Environmentalists are now worried about the impact of this project on the island. That's all for today. For more news and analysis, log on to business-standard.com. We'll be back tomorrow with our next episode. Thank you for watching.
For more news, views and updates, subscribe to Business Standard on Google Podcast, Apple Podcast and Spotify. Also follow us on YouTube, Vimeo, Instagram, Twitter, Facebook and LinkedIn.